Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Judge Business Debate. My name is Michael Kitson and I'm an economist here at Judge Business School in Cambridge. In this series, specialists from the Cambridge Judge Business School and the wider Cambridge community discuss and debate topical issues of business and management. In today's session, we are focusing on alternative finance, those forms of finance that have emerged outside of traditional finance and banking. In this podcast, we'll explore what is the alternative finance and what are the implications for business, the economy and public policy. Joining to me today are three guests. I have Stelios Kavadias, the Margaret Thatcher Professor of Enterprise Studies in Innovation and Growth and Director of the Entrepreneurship Centre at the Judge Business School. Secondly, Bart Lambrecht, the Professor of Finance at the Judge Business School and Director of the Cambridge Endowment for Research in Finance. And thirdly, but certainly not finally, Bob Wardrop, co-founder and director of the Cambridge Centre for Alternative Finance. So welcome to my three guests. So finance is the main lubricator of modern capitalism, but the financial sector itself is going through a period of rapid change with the emergence of various forms of new and alternative finance. Finance is now awash with a confusing range of new products and technologies, such as cryptocurrencies, crowdfunding and peer-to-peer lending. So perhaps we can start with perhaps the most obvious question, what is alternative finance? Bob, perhaps you could kick off with us.
Thanks, Michael. Well, I think it's as much as useful in some ways to understand what it is as opposed to and what it isn't. What it isn't, and what some people I think initially think it might be, is private equity or what people in finance often refer to as alternative investments. In fact, many alternative investments, such as private equity or some people would even call infrastructure an alternative investment, are very much part of the incumbent system. There are well-established rules. Investors are usually regulated that engage in those activities, at least from an investor or an investment manager perspective. We're interested in alternative channels and instruments that emerge from outside of the incumbent system. Frankly, because that's where the interesting disruption is coming from, the reasons that these instruments and channels emerge are worth studying. And perhaps most importantly, the incumbent system has to deal with this disruption. How does it absorb it? What does it do with it? Does it kill it? So I think the discussion to me is, and what we study in the center is very, very interesting around what does all this mean for the financial system, the lives of people, and how we run our businesses.
So what are the most important sources of alternative finance?
Well, in terms of funding sources?
In terms of types, because we can see such a range. When we're hearing, we're talking about cryptocurrencies and peer-to-peer lending and crowdfunding. And just trying to work out what are the main sources.
So I think,
what are the main types of alternative finance?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about channels specifically, we're talking about equity funding channels, peer-to-peer lending, so debt financing of businesses. But there are also non-financial sources, which are related to, say, philanthropic or reward-based, which from an organizational perspective can be very, very important in terms of crowdsourcing the testing of new product and new innovation before going to market or competing larger financing. And then I think alternative payments and crypto assets, or what we call tokenized assets, are extremely important, which is really a fundamental change that may be quite structural in the transparency that it brings to business operations and finance activities.
Stelios.
I think I would agree with Bob along the lines of the keyword channels, right? I think essentially, that's a good definition in my mind in terms of putting forward the fact that there is ways by which, transactions and money is flowing between different parties and what exactly that money is used for, in my view at least, coming as an outsider, I would say, right, to this financial industry, seems to be the finance part of it. Now, interestingly enough, I think what becomes very critical in this is what the absorption component that Bob mentioned already. The story that there is these new channels. These channels, for some reason, have emerged without the consent of the incumbents. That's interesting why this happened, although that's a recurrent phenomenon in different industries, right, with respect to innovation. And then the other interesting component there is that how the absorption is happening now that our friends at the incumbents are seeing new alternative payments that they don't control, or they see the fact that loans might be happening outside of the traditional realm of valuations and ways by which they would decide the criteria, right? And it seems, at least from the standpoint of somebody like myself, who looks at startup firms and firms that try to disrupt the existing sort of industries, it seems that the incumbents are have been getting worried for some time now. Maybe over the last couple of years, they seem to be less worried in terms of they seem to have found a way by which they're dealing with this alternative finance hype. But still, we don't know where this new equilibrium is going to rest.
So if I can follow up to that, yes. So one important element is the element of technology-enabled disintermediation, which kind of cuts out the middleman and which in some ways could have posed a threat to the traditional incumbent. So let me give you an illustrative example. Say peer-to-peer lending, as we might see it currently available to consumers. So under the traditional banking model, you might have had that savers put their money in the bank, deposits, and the bank then is the intermediary that will lend this to businesses and households as loans. The bank will essentially make the money from the difference between the lending rate and the borrowing rate. So in other words, if some of these loans go bad, the profits of the bank are going to be cut. And banks that issue very bad loans may actually go out of business and default. Yeah. Now, if I compare it with, say, a standard peer-to-peer lending model, which you might have accessible to consumers, there you would have a platform that immediately matches the borrowers with the lenders. So in other words, at the platform, they may kind of post a number of loans that are available to the borrowers. The borrowers can then, sorry, to the lenders. Lenders can study these projects and then decide whether or not they want to buy a part of that particular loan. The platform acts kind of more like a middleman here who charges fees. So they don't take these loans onto their balance sheet. It's really the lender who does. So in other words, if some of these loans go bad and default, it's immediately going to be the lender, the investor, who will kind of suffer. And so in that way, it kind of is quite different. So it's very different having investing in peer-to-peer lending than having, say, a savings account.
That's painted quite a negative picture of it. But a counter-argument, and I'll come back to Bob in a minute if I may, but a counter-argument is that this platform makes the market more efficient and reduces down the costs, certainly the costs and the profits that will be taken by the banks. So actually, the financial market is more efficient. And some people take risks, but they may lose out from that.
Yes.
And also, of course, when big banks lose because of systemic risk, the regulators come in and protect them. So perhaps helping to solve the moral hazard problem.
Sure. So clearly, certain costs can be cut out, and that it can also increase competition. So banks obviously may have to compete with new entrants, and all of this could potentially increase the returns that investors could get on their money. There are clearly, if you go to some of these peer-to-peer lending firms, they can offer you returns in excess of 6%. That does not mean that these 6% returns will be achieved, but clearly it's way more than what people could get on a traditional savings account. So in that sense, yes, it can increase efficiency, increase competition, and also increase access to funding by borrowers by speeding up the whole process.
Bob.
One of the things I think I want to follow up on something Bart said, because I think it was a very good point. You know, I think we tend to see this as a disintermediating process. And what we often forget, actually, it's re-intermediating. It's just a question of who then becomes the intermediator. So that's one point I'd like to make. A peer-to-peer lender, this is not a completely disintermediated activity. You have someone in the middle performing some value-added function that an investor is prepared to pay for. Okay. The second point is the market is bifurcating. Okay. So what Bart described as the peer-to-peer lending model is essentially an asset manager-like model. I mean, essentially, this model has become sophisticated to the point where, I'm not picking my loans with no value added provided by that platform operator. Those platform operators are investing heavily in technology and algorithms on credit scoring to be able to construct portfolios of my loans for me. It's to the point where most platforms today are simply like any asset manager does when you sign up. What is your risk return tolerance? Here's the expected rate of return for the risk you can tolerate. And they basically fill up your portfolio. Is that really banking? I mean, at the end of the day, the incentives and the more hazard risks you could align are much more like asset management. Really, that platform is becoming a robo-advisor in a self-originated, domain of investment products. It happens to be peer-to-peer loans to either consumers or businesses. On the other hand, you have platforms that are moving totally away from taking money from individuals. They're focused on generating institutional investment. They're using what capital, you know, in basically funding structures that banks use, right? They just don't take deposits. But, you know, they're using securitization markets, they're bundling those, they're selling them in capital markets, and they're using very sophisticated algorithms to actually pick, select their loans. They're taking balance sheet risk. So you've got that as a very bank-like model, and I don't think what people generally understand when they look at this market is this bifurcation that's going on, because regulators, frankly, are catching up. No one's regulated today like really being an asset manager, even if, you know, they effectively are acting in that manner.
I think the regulation part is becoming an interesting part in the discussion here, right? And the fact that the regulators are catching up implies a somewhat typical situation in many innovation cycles where there's this new way of doing things, right? And we get into that and we don't really understand exactly how the new way of doing things is going to affect every single constituent in the ecosystem. And at some point, that creates value initially because obviously people rushed there because there was something to be chased. But as we go and we learn more, we will start understanding also the risks that might be happening. I don't know exactly how the risks are going to, you know, manifest themselves, but potentially those risks will call for the bigger boys or the regulators or the bigger companies or the regulators to just step back in and create a new situation, a new equilibrium, as I said before. So I think something that might be useful to clarify, and I'm just reading this from discussions with fintechs, right? So take it with a grain of salt, is the fact that...
Just tell us what is fintech?
Technology-driven companies that enable those new alternative financial channels.
The financial innovation.
Exactly. It's financial innovation, yes. It's not product innovation, though, necessarily, right?
Right.
It might be also the technology that enables certain products to come across. But I think those fintechs, there was this dream a few years back that the fintechs are going to just topple over the big banks and no HSBCs or whatever banks you could see, right, in this. And I think we're now coming to the conclusion that the new world will have banks and it will have some new players, potentially new alternative channels, tech, big tech companies like the Alibabas of this world offering certain financial services. But also the banks will have some say into this bigger picture. That's just an interesting equilibrium that's emerging. I'm unsure where the regulator is standing on that, because now those risks are going to start becoming more clear, perhaps, in terms of the new system and new way of doing business.
But
I agree, and I think regulation is going to be important, because currently this alternative finance sector is still relatively unregulated. And as always, it only takes a few bad apples to undermine the confidence of the consumers and investors in this kind of alternative form of finance. So I'll just give one example, but of course these are just exceptions. But in 2015, there was, for instance, a Swedish peer-to-peer lender that went bankrupt once it became apparent that there was malpractice among management. So what, for instance, had happened was that loans had been issued without the consent of lenders, and more troubling, sometimes there was some loans were not directly linked to specific lenders. And so obviously this whole technology based infrastructure, while potentially very efficient and very smart, it could also reduce potentially the transparency, increase the scope for fraud or even cyber risk and the like. And so regulation is obviously an important component as this market is going to grow bigger, because it's not only important for the alternative finance sector, but potentially also if that sector were to be affected, it could spill over into the more regular sector.
So Bart makes a good point. Look, I think the challenge when people, the average person looks at this marketplace, right, is you're always going to be able to spot the trust buddies, that, you know, the situations where you've had default problems. And Bart's right, that could potentially destabilize the market. The problem is, right, in our view, I mean, we've done a lot of analysis with certain lenders in the UK on the performance of their loans versus performance of bank loans, for example, to SMEs. Now, the platform cohort that we picked, looking at all those loans, I would describe as having pretty good operational practices, probably better than the mean of the market. And as a result, they outperform, Okay, so the problem is not the mean performance. I would argue maybe the mean performance is at least as good as banks operationally. A lot of them are former bankers. And actually, they have no legacy IT systems. I mean, there's a lot they can do in innovating. The problem is the distribution around the mean. And what you don't want to be as an investor is have exposure on the third and particularly the fourth quartile in operational risk on these platforms. The bottom end of the bucket is pretty bad, I suspect, in terms of operational performance. It's like investing in venture capital. All the returns are in the top quartile. But it doesn't mean the venture capital industry doesn't have value in the economy.
Exactly.
I think that's an important point I'd make.
But it's the bottom tail that could cause a systemic risk problem.
Correct. That's the bottom tail. It's a long tail. Yeah. Because it's easy. There's low barriers to entry to get into the market. And I think the people on the top quartile are increasingly worried about risk they can't control, which is the, it could be a fraudulent event, it could be an operational breakdown, it could be something in that long tail bottom quarter that's going to affect their business. I think that keeps some of them up at night.
Could I just to clarify some issue, it relates particularly to regulation, but it relates to something, Bob, you're mentioning before. I mean, are we talking about really two separate domains here of alternative finance and traditional finance? Or is many of the aspects of alternative finance just becoming new traditional finance? Because that has an impact on regulation. Because we know the banks are highly regulated. Well, they have increased regulation in the financial sector since the financial crisis, and it varies across different markets and different countries. We can say whether it's correct or not, but we do know the financial sector is far more regulated than in retail or the tech space, where many of these new alternative finance products or services are emerging. So that's less of a problem if all of these fintech end up getting merged back in to traditional finance.
Yeah, I think that we need to be careful of one thing. Focusing on the fintechs too much, even the well-established peer-to-peer lenders or blockchain companies or cryptocurrency companies, frankly, it's a bit of a red herring. I mean, it's the Amazons and it's the Alibabas and it's the big tech, right? Now, actually, if you talk to regulators, actually, regulators are not against those players coming into markets like the lending markets. Why? Because in their view, it reduces systemic risk. Okay, you've got more players. They've got very good data. This is all about analytics. This is all about credit scoring. They've got platform business models. They've got very powerful platforms. Once you've got payments, you can layer on all kinds of other things at very low marginal cost and high return and network effect value to the users of the platform, right? So it's those guys, I think, who are going to be the big players. And regulators are migrating away from the current sort of mode of regulation where I'm regulating you as a bank and all that a bank encompasses to something that they will call activity-based regulation. So if you just want to do consumer loans and you don't take deposits, you don't necessarily need to be regulated like a bank. That's where it's going. There are certain jurisdictions, I would say Singapore, very aggressive in this way, different jurisdictions around the world, pushing the activity-based agenda as a regulatory approach hard. And I think that's coming because the blurring between what we call financial and non-financial today in a digital organization is blurring.
So I would agree that probably most of the alternative finance would fall under the existing regulation. This being said, some of these new products do not necessarily fall under it and allow for new types of products to be created. Let me give the example of, say, initial coin offerings, which is a bit like an IPO, not quite, but one key difference is that many of those...
Can you tell us what an initial coin offering is?
Okay, initial coin offering is basically firms that try to raise finance by issuing tokens. So it's a little bit like a cryptocurrency, and these tokens can then later be exchanged potentially for some of the products or projects that the firms are doing. So it gives you some kind of a stake in a firm, but it's quite different from a traditional share. Now, one important difference is that most of these firms that issue these ICOs may try to make sure it is not considered by the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, or the regulator as a security, so that it doesn't fall under that regulation. And so you have products that potentially are developed with specific purposes, not to fall under one regulation, but then it's not quite exactly clear how they are being regulated.
So I think that what you're seeing from small countries, okay, is they see an arbitrage opportunity here. Okay, so Bart, I mean, really what you're describing in the initial coin off, that token is really, it's a set of rights and obligations, contractual rights, between the investor and the token and the issuer. You're buying a right to something associated with an application or an activity of a firm. It could be very equity-like, very debt-like, or something completely different, okay? If you're a Switzerland, you're a Bermuda, Malta, I could, you know, name 6 or 7 jurisdictions that really feel that they kind of missed industrialization, that they were really on the wrong side of that, it kind of got away from them. Really see creating a regulatory environment that is more bespoke to accommodating these kinds of activities around the securities issues in the United States as a huge opportunity. If we look at the history of Luxembourg, for example, and how they arbitrage European financial services, very important in terms of how these small players are coming together and actually collaborating together against some of the larger firms as this new wave comes.
I'm wondering, I mean, in what you just described, Bob, I'm wondering to what extent the, in this issue, especially the ICOs, right? I'm trying to understand a bit about what Bart said. To what extent that will bring the, for the lack of a better description, the real collateral of developing and getting the economy off, as opposed to are we really investing in some kind of a semi-Ponzi story there where, you know, all of a sudden I missed industrialization, there's no real value economic activity going on. So you know what, guys, I'm going to create the regulation so that you can come and you can trade with all this slightly new and slightly unregulated in the rest of the big markets financial means to drive my local economy. Is that creating a bit more systemic risk?
This is an interesting debate among us, right? Like, I feel quite strongly there is no tokenization is inevitable because the digitalization of our economy is inevitable. And tokenization is a function of the digital processes of organizations. Like, I'll give you an example of an ICO that's, I think, quite, well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I'm borrowing the argument, I'll have to be honest here, from the latest, one of the main press magazines that I was reading, having a little bit of a discussion about this. It seems to me that right now the volatility of all these tokens out there makes it a challenging means to actually assume that it's going to take over and all of a sudden we're not going to be trading in British pounds anymore, but we're going to be using some kind of another token.
Now,
to put it bluntly, would I take my mortgage in one of the cryptocurrencies right now or in British pound? For the time being, maybe it's going to change in the future, right? But for the time being, the volatility that you see for the average person out there is so high that I don't think we will see that. Now, does this mean that the British pound is going to become a token in the future and we're going to have a digital version? That's a different avenue and it could very well happen, right? But it's...
So I think there's a huge education issue because when we talked about cryptocurrencies, that's a very different issue than talking about tokenization.
Okay.
So cryptocurrencies are kind of one flavor of tokenization, right?
Yes.
But I can tokenize gold. I mean, this Chicago Mercantile Exchange has an exchange-tradable digital gold
and that
token.
That has a collateral. Now you just described something that basically instead of issuing papers, you issue something digital, ally paper, which actually reflects on a real collateral, right?
Yeah.
That's the idea. True. But the cryptocurrencies have done that with a new collateral, which is not even existing and regulated at some level,
but
right?
But if Starbucks issues tokens as an incentive loyalty mechanism, and you can trade in your tokens for a cup of coffee, and 6 tokens is worth a cup of coffee, then you can certainly exchange your token to somebody that's prepared to pay something for it because 6 of them buys a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And by the way, Starbucks is introducing tokens.
That's absolutely fine as long as we are able, at some level, systemically, to deal with the nice little ups and downs that are going to be happening once you get these tokens into the hands of the big boys who want to play games.
Well, that depends
right?
on whether the price of a copy of Starbucks cup of coffee goes up and down.
But these tokens are backed by something, whereas cryptocurrencies are not.
No, but I think...
That's the collateral argument.
Collateral argument. You did say there's a difference. I mean, we often merge the two together, and there's a difference between these initial coin offerings, as I understand it, and certainly...
So what's the Zimbabwean dollar back?
Well, it's not much at the moment.
A lot of people would rather hold Bitcoin than Zimbabwean dollars.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, traditional currencies were backed by gold and silver.
And the legitimized use of violence by the issuer.
But now they're backed by the issuer. They're backed by nation states. Now, some nation states are more reliable than others.
Because they have the right to... They have powerful armies.
But what are cryptocurrencies backed by?
Well, say, for instance, with the ICOs, the initial coin offerings, the tokens, they would be driven primarily by the credibility and the fortunes of that particular company.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So what you've got is something that potentially is self-enforcing on both ways. Yeah. So a company that issued these coins and its product is doing really well, it kind of is successful, the coins obviously will become much more valuable. That will reinforce people's use of the tokens and it will become an eco kind of environment where everyone is kind of trading in these tokens for that within that company. But on the other hand, if things start really going badly, then what you've got is that the same forces will then go against you, right? Because people are also then tied in through these tokens with a company. And the moment a company starts doing poorly, these tokens become worthless. People may try to then get out. And so the whole...
Well, yes and no.
It increases potentially volatility again, right?
It could, but if I buy equity in a startup, I mean, 9 out of 10, I'll never see my money. So that's not so odd. There's been 1,600 cryptocurrencies issued over the past 3 or 4 years. And I would say maybe 20 of them have some exchange value of some kind. I mean, 90% of them have died and trended down to zero. There's some great graph work on that. I think the token is interesting. We talked about, it's really a set of rights and obligations, contractual, that actually, it can be structured. If the company dies that launches a product, for example, the product may live. And my rights to collect revenues or royalties or whatever my rights are, don't die. So those rights can be, the life of the company can be separated from the life of the token. It's a very important concept. And so I think there's a huge lack of understanding.
Are you saying legally, if the company were to go bankrupt, that these tokens still have value?
Yes, because the issuing, whoever is the issuer, right, is issuing a token that has a set of rights and obligations, depending on the relationship of that company to that application or activity to which I have a claim, right? As long as that activity continues, which it can in a digital world, I would encourage you to look at something like Filecoin, which is an Airbnb of file storage, where basically a token buys access to store your files on whoever is making their storage on their laptop available around the world. Okay? Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, I can go to Amazon Cloud, but that's like staying in the Ritz-Carlton. Maybe I don't want to stay in the Ritz-Carlton. Maybe I want to stay in a one-room B&B. Why? Maybe because I want my files to not be exposed to security services. Maybe because I'm just cheap. Maybe. But is the excess file storage capacity in the world worth anything? If it is, the collective tokens that give access to that have some value. And if the company that created the network dies, well, the network lives. That's what I mean. I think there's a lot to learn here about why tokenization is fundamentally embedded as a concept in the digital evolution of our economy.
I'm thinking. I mean, this is interesting. One thing that you just mentioned, which actually I think we should put on the table for the sake of the listeners, is the fact that if there is something that I think alternative finance methods have done, is they've opened up the existing products at some level to a far wider audience, right? So let's go into that side, which you just mentioned this, with tokens that I don't want to stay under Ritz-Carlton, but now there's cheaper, easier ways for the untokenized before.
If you have digital infrastructure.
Exactly. But digital infrastructure is becoming more and more predominant, right? That's not the question. I'm still struggling with the idea of the issuer going off business, but then the product staying on in a digital world, because in every system, somebody has to guarantee.
Unless it's decentralized, and that's the whole idea of blockchain. The governance mechanisms are built into the protocol level of the core of the code in the blockchain network. That's the key to blockchain, is you don't need digital business. If we take what I would call today a digital core company, those that have emerged since the internet, right? They develop platform business models, they capture network effects, highly centralized, like Amazon. The big shift that's occurring, that blockchain enables, is to decentralize those network effects. You don't need an Amazon to run the whole thing. That's the beauty. You just don't.
But you don't create efficiencies either. in the system. And I'm not sure.
This is a huge debate, right? Yeah, and I think exactly. I think if you were to read our report of 3 weeks ago, conceptualizing distributed ledger technologies, it addresses these issues.
And I'm sure many listeners will actually, but they can download it from the website. I'm conscious of the time. I just want to ask one final. Again, it's a big issue question, which reflects some of this debate we've just been having. Is really, what do you think the overall impact of alternative finance will be for the wider economy or wider society? I mean, is this going to have beneficial effects by making markets more efficient reducing costs and create more competition? Or there'll be potential harmful effects in terms of widening inequality if you have access to these markets? Or is this the source of the next financial crisis? Because we've talked about regulation before. I always tend to think regulators are always regulating to stop the past financial crisis happening again. We never quite know where the next one will appear. So I just want to get you a sort of broad view about the costs and benefits of alternative finance for the wider economy. Bart.
Okay, well, undoubtedly, I think these new forms of alternative finance create competition. And that in itself, I think, is usually a good thing.
Usually, not always.
Yeah, usually. Yeah. But so it also may lead to more efficiency. And we've discussed this already, cutting costs, increased speed. And so on the whole, I think it is a good thing, yeah? And it will benefit also consumers. But this being said, we have highlighted a number of potential issues. Every coin has its two sides, right? And increase in efficiency and so on may at the same time also come with potential risk. And particularly we've highlighted things like fraud, the fact that we don't quite know yet how it's going to affect volatility in the market, particularly if we were to have a crisis. It's not quite known and tested what the response of cryptocurrencies and alternative finance is going to be in another financial crisis and how resilient this system is going to be. But that's just the way things are. Every coin has its two sides, and you can't disentangle the two. So I think the key thing will be for the regulator to try to make sure that fraud and potential other harmful effects to the regulator can be contained. And so that's an important element.
Stelios.
I think if we start by the idea that this is the outcome of innovation, and by the fact that usually innovation, taking a slightly different view, right? Usually innovation is associated with bettering things, right?
Although innovation can be bad.
Yes, yes.
Particularly in the financial markets. Yeah.
We have seen that. We had a crisis based on the innovation that happened sometime in the 90s. But I think still we always end up in a new equilibrium, which is slightly different and usually better than what we started with, despite the fact that we might go through the valley of death or whatever this is from an innovation standpoint. So given that, I think eventually we're going to be looking at changes. I mean, what Bob described as the tokenization or digitalization, I think that's broader. It goes beyond only the financial channels, right? In every aspect of the business, you see a certain sense of disintermediation or new intermediation, as you said, re-intermediation based on the technologies. And the fundamental thing behind this is information, right? Is the fact that now all of a sudden we can manipulate information in better ways because we can capture it. We have the technologies, we have the ways to actually utilize innovation and information and take away the inefficiencies in the previous system. So long story short, I think we will see things being better in the longer run. Should we envision that there are going to be some risks in between? Yeah, most likely. With every innovation, we have this cycle, right?
Yeah, I think it's around the unknown unknowns. And I think that if I talk to central bankers, and what in the back of their mind are they kind of, is really making them nervous about all this? And I would say it's they don't want another 2008. They see the whole sort of structured products phenomenon, the black boxes, and people really didn't understand what the mechanisms were within those that was producing systemic risk and the interrelationships of counterparties in the market. Mm-hmm. They're concerned, even something as simple as allowing the emerging innovative sort of, let's call them alternative finance players, to use cloud platforms. You've got a very small number of cloud-based platforms. Does that introduce a new form of systemic risk in the financial system? They worry about this kind of stuff. Artificial intelligence. Are we able to get transparency on decision-making and outputs? What's the impact on privacy? What's the input of tokenization on the commoditization of work, from a social perspective? Am I just an input with token value in terms of whatever skills I have plugging into production systems? I think there's a huge number of really big questions that this whole transition to digital, not just in finance, I think finance highlights it. I think Stelios has made the point, yeah, it's finance, but you know, this is part of a bigger thing going on, I think is the right way to look at this phenomenon.
Great, thank you very much indeed. But we have run out of time, but I'd like to thank my guests, Bob Wardrop, Bart Lambrecht, and Stelios Kavadias for contributing and missing their lunch today to join us. You can find further details about the Judge Business School on our website, Twitter, and other social media. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you can join us next time.